Welcome to Innovation and Leadership. I'm Jess Larson. On this episode, I get to have Rob Ferguson. Rob is an very experienced former CEO and advisor. He ran a $300 million public company, a $100 million family-owned company. Nowadays, he does a lot of exit planning and helping kind of business-first family businesses in their transitions and a lot of other interesting things. Rob, thanks for doing this.
Yeah, nice to be here with you, Jess. Thanks for having me.
So I was interested in this for a few reasons. I really want to know about your time, you know, doing turnarounds and growing businesses a lot, as well as I'm very interested in the exit business. I mean, most founders and investment fund managers who I get to hang out with, like this is a, you know, there's two things that are really important, raising the money and then selling the business or taking it public, right? And getting that outcome on a private business. So I started my my real career, I say, you know, I started 20-something years ago on an M&A team for Citi.
Okay.
Trying to talk, you know, sub $500 million a year companies into letting us sell their business. And we'd get a bunch of PE firms and potential buyers. And my job was to call the CEO and say, like, are you going to give this business to the kids? Do you want to sell part now and take a second bite of the apple after the PE fund grows it? What do you want to do? You know, just hear what they're thinking after 30 years around this company. And you're doing that on like a whole level above where I was. So I'm excited to talk about it. So why don't we start with your firm and what you've been doing for the last decade?
Yep. So we're Ferguson Alliance. We're a boutique advisory firm. We work with the upper end of the small market, the lower end of the middle market, depending upon how you define it. We like to define it a company with 50 to 1,000 employees, maybe 50 to 500 million in annual revenue. Those are kind of generalizations of the types of businesses we work with. And we help them really increase their prosperity and their longevity. Yeah.
Well, I really want to talk about it, but I kind of want to talk about the career that led up to this.
Okay.
Can you talk a little bit about becoming a CEO for the first time?
Yeah, I sure can. I was very young when I became the CEO. When I say very young, I was, I think, in my 40s. I had a pretty fast career in my late 20s through late 30s inside of Weyerhaeuser. Got some great training there and was part of a management buyout of a small little division that Weyerhaeuser was divesting. And that's where I cut my teeth on M&A. And I was actually recently married and didn't have any money. And so I went to my father-in-law and asked him for his entire pension plan so I could participate in this leverage management buyout. He didn't know what I was talking about. I honestly didn't know what I was talking about. He wrote me the big check and I put it in. And I don't know if I would have done that for my son-in-law, but he did it. And it really worked out really great. 4 years later, it made me feel really good to give him his check back with little interest on top. So it worked out really well. We grew that business. And I think my experiences were really all very practical, learning how to do acquisitions. We failed on a couple. So those were some very helpful lessons. We did really well on a couple. Those were good lessons. But as I look back on it, the better lessons for me were our missteps and our failures. And this was going back in the 80s and 90s. And I have to be honest with myself. I could have fallen off a log and made money. Those are some easy years to make money and good returns. And then as we entered into the 2000s, it got a lot more challenging. That was my take on growing a business, raising funds, raising private funds through private equity, raising public funds through the public equity markets, raising debt. Private debt and public debt. I did all of that. And it was a great education. I don't know where else I would have gotten that kind of an education. And that was my first tenure as a CEO.
Yeah. How much do you think you raised altogether across the different formats?
Let's see. It was probably $350 million, somewhere in that neighborhood.
Yeah. And what do you think the valuation of the company got to, market cap-wise or whatever?
Well, we probably got up to, in the day, maybe $400 million. It was a struggle. That's when we got to the 2000s. We finally, I left as a CEO in 2003, I think. I'm trying to remember. No, that's incorrect. 2007 is when I left, and then I went into the family business, which was a whole nother story. So my story on my first CEO was growing a business, and then the CEO position I went into the family business was turning it around. So two different skill sets.
On the public company side, you know, raising money is something that is eternally interesting to founders and CEOs and even investment fund managers who need to get their next LP. What's a piece of advice that you have across those years and learning how to bring in $350 million?
Well, for me, what I learned is it's not so much about how much you know about your business. It's more about how your business is going to return profit to the investors. I think that was a big mistake that I had made early on. Is I grew up, you know, the business was part of me. I grew up in the business for all practical sake, and I didn't know why nobody would not love the business as much as I loved the business. I had a great vision, a wonderful management team, terrific employees. All of those features of a high-performing business were there, very profitable. But what I didn't understand was what's in the odds are of the investors, whether it was equity or debt. And I learned that, and it took me a while to learn that. Once I learned that, then I was able to recalibrate how I communicated and what I focused on as a CEO.
You know, it echoes some of the good advice I've learned from people who've raised a lot more than me about, you know, maybe you don't start with the presentation and the pitch deck. Maybe you start by asking, what's their mandate and, you know, what does success look like to them? And, you know, what makes a go, no-go decision for them? And, you know, who's on the investment committee they're going to have to repeat this to? And spend a lot of time on that before you ever get into yourself.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I remember doing my road shows and, you know, it'd be lunch and there's probably 30 or 40 fund managers out there. And again, I was 40 something and these guys listening to me were 20 something. Probably had more alphabets after their name than I did. And, you know, I don't know. I had to learn how to relate to that audience. And I did exactly that. I quit just doing the presentation and trying to make sure I understood who the audience was, what they were looking for, and whether or not we were going to be a fit. I think that was the other thing is we're not a fit. We were not a fit for everybody. Our returns were going to take longer. We were in the agriculture business. That has different risk profile. So I didn't understand all of that until I got into it. And then once it became clear to me, I did exactly that. I just made sure we're getting married to the right people.
Yeah, it's interesting. Were you the CEO? Like, did you take it public while you were CEO,
or was that already? I came in right after it went public. Yeah, okay. So I was a COO during the time. Yeah.
So for so many folks in my universe, it's a lot of private companies, you know? What advice would you give to a founder, to a CEO who's considering going public? What would be different about their life once they're publicly traded?
Well, number one, it's going to cost you a lot of money. And it takes a lot of money to make money. And the idea that founders have that public money is free is is incorrect. In other words, well, I'm just going to sell some equity. I get this free money. It's different from going to the bank and having to pay interest. You're still going to pay to go public. It's very expensive to be public. We went public right at right before Sarbanes-Oxley, about 3 years. And I remember, just as an example, I think our audit fees were, these aren't going to be precise numbers, but I think we were paying $200,000 a year, maybe $250,000 for annual audits, and then it skyrocketed to $2 million. Again, that was right at the beginning of Sarbanes-Oxley. So it's expensive. Number two, your life's got to be different because you've never had a boss before, and now you do, and you can't see your boss. You're going to talk to a few of them on your quarterly conference calls, and they don't want to hear all about the nuances and details that you know about your business, about your products. What they want to hear about is, what's the financial health of the business? How are you growing the business? How much market share do you have? Are you going to hit your quarterly earnings? So moving from a family private business, that most family private businesses have a very long-term horizon. Where are we going to be in 20 years for the next generation? You move into the public sector, there is not a 20-year horizon. You're lucky if there is a 3 to 5 year horizon. Most likely, though, you're going to be constantly measured against a quarterly horizon.
Any advice for CEOs who feel like this pressure for short-term thinking, even when they know long-term thinking is correct?
I think you need to stick to your guns, and long-term thinking must trump short-term thinking. And no matter what business you're in, our family business owners struggle with this all the time. You know, are we trying to maintain control of our business? Are we trying to grow our business? Or are we trying to have liquidity in our business? So it's this three-legged stool they're constantly balancing. And so when you enter into the public sector, it's all about growing the business and not so much control of the business or the ownership. And so that's a different way of thinking, and you'll have to change your mind around that. I would also say private family businesses should not consider it until they're much larger than what we were. We were a private equity sponsored company that went public. We were traded very thinly, and it was just not the right, in my opinion, it was not the right strategy to go forward. And again, at the time, I wasn't the CEO, I was the COO. And so those decisions were ultimately made by the board of directors, which I never felt like it was a good idea for our business. But I sure did learn a lot going through the process. And I can't imagine how a $300 million or $500 million company could go public these days. It just doesn't make sense to me. I think that there's too many other ways to recap your business than going into the public sector, because it takes a lot of time, it takes a lot of money, and it does change your focus if you're not careful.
Yeah. Let's talk about the next chapter, the family business. Tell us that story.
Yeah, that was a really great chapter. A lot of fun. I enjoyed the first one a lot. That was my learning stage.
And sorry, what were you doing in agriculture in the first one?
Yeah, it was a horticulture business. Anyway, so the next chapter was industrial packaging business. And it was a 100-year-old company's fifth generation was running it. It was a hot mess. It was losing money. I can't remember. There was more than a dozen cousins involved in the business, either working in the business or owning the business. And they needed to fix the business and then sell the business. The three family trees had become very dysfunctional and just could not do business going forward after 100 years. So I came in as an independent, non-family member CEO to do that, to fix the business and then sell it, which we did do. And we sold. It was a great sale. It was a private sale. And I think all the family members ultimately were happy. you know, obviously some didn't want to sell the business. They wanted to preserve their family legacy through their name, but most everybody were pleased to get out of that business and go their separate ways. And while I was doing that, I didn't know much about family business because I was always in either a VC-sponsored or private equity-sponsored company or a public company or then standing up our own kind of public company. So more institutional. Moved into the family business. I was asked to sit on a board of a family office in Georgia. They're very successful, 100-year-old business, fifth generation, but it was thriving. It was doing very well. And they would hire operating guys like myself to go sit on their, they had a private equity fund, and they would ask us to go sit on their boards to, you know, give some advice and as well as give feedback to the family office on how their investment was behaving. From there, I learned a lot about family businesses. I learned about succession. I learned about training family beneficiaries, expectations that the family members had on one another. I learned about, I would say, exiting family businesses, but still keeping the legacy of the family together. So it was great. It was a great time for me. I was turning around a family business that wasn't performing very well. And then I was sitting as a board member in a very successfully run fifth generation family business.
And on that turnaround, like how much better did you make it? Like from when you took over till when you exited, how much of a change was there?
Let's see. Well, we went from losing money to making money, and we did that in 2 years, and then we actually got it sold. I'm trying to remember. So we were losing, I don't know, what can I say in percentages? Maybe 200% better, something like that. The turnaround was all about understanding what was causing the problem. And when you walk into a business, any turnaround manager will tell you the first thing to do is to do an assessment on the financial side of the business, but also the non-financial side. The board of directors, this business had a board of directors. It told me, the board said, that the only problem was that they'd lost about 30% of their revenue, 25 to 30% of their revenue. If we get that back, everything's going to be great because it was a distribution business. So kind of low margins, fixed costs. So, yep, raise the revenue, all will be good. What I found out when I did my due diligence is, yes, maybe that's what we need to do, but our on-time delivery was 65%. So the problem is if you increase revenue and you only delivered on it 65% of the time on time, the thing was going to implode. So we had to sequence things, right? We had to go in and fix the operations that what was causing us not to be on time, get that on time back up, and then we
could. Yeah, from 65 to what?
Yeah, we finally got it up to 90%. We didn't get it. Our goal was 97%. We never got it that high. We got it up 90, low 90s.
What was an example of one of the processes or one of the tactics or one of the things that changed?
Yeah, is the one thing we put in that they didn't have is a sales and operation planning process. And we systematized that. And that included sales forecasting. We were not doing any kind of forecasting. And so the problem that we had is we would have a lot of obsolete inventory growing in the warehouse because our inventory was misaligned with what the market was demanding at the time. So once we put that S&OP process in, systematized it, got sales involved in forecasting, it flipped around very quickly.
Yeah, that's great. And so was it straight from there to exit planning, or did you do things in between?
No, I sat on some boards. I went to a couple of private equity firms here in Houston with a thesis on acquiring a business, worked with them for about a year, made some offers, nothing ever closed. I was ready to do something, and so I started being asked to help some other family businesses, and my wife asked me, when are you going to do something? And I said, well, I'm doing something, I think. She said, well, are you going to turn this into a business? And I said, well, I never thought about that. I've always been an operations guy, never been an advisor, a consultant. Let me give it a go. So it was never, there was no design behind it. All of our calls, even today, here we are 14 years later, everything's a referral business. And so one family company or one family office would refer me to another family office, to another family business. And that's how we evolved today. And one of the things that I learned along the way was how important family business is to our economy, to our philanthropy, to innovation. And so that really motivated me because I was now moving into my late 50s and wanted to be more purposeful and have a bigger impact, so to speak, at least in a little small corner of the world. And as I was doing research for various clients, I learned in the 1950s, the average lifespan of a business, whether it was family or a non-family, was 60 years. But then when we get to modern times, the average lifespan of a family business, we now track it separately, is 24 years. So it went from 60 to 24. S&P 500, I think these are 2022 stats, is 15 years. So family businesses do have a longer life cycle than S&P 500, but it's been reduced significantly from 60. And that really shaped up my kind of my vision of creating an advisory firm, which is to help break that trend, at least with the clients that we're working with, to extend their life cycle and extend their legacy.
So when you think about the M&A world today, what's something that's changed in the last decade? What's something that you think founders may want to think about a little bit differently today?
Technology obviously has sped up a lot of things. And to me, owners have to be prepared to make decisions. And in order to make decisions, you have to anticipate what is going to be asked. If you are doing the acquiring, you need to be very clear on why you're acquiring that business and what your parameters are. If you're being acquired, you need to understand what's the strategic reason you're being asked to come in to the business acquiring you. So to me, it's being fast in your decision making, but being well prepared. We work with most of our clients at least 5 years before an event is to happen, because it takes time to get the back office situated, the financials in a GAAP format, get some audits or at least reviews in place so we have some bona fides. We even will do Q of E's in advance of an acquisition or a transition, just so the whole organization is prepared financially. Then we have to look at the management team, the bench strength of the management team. We have to look at the operating systems, the business processes, all of those things. The more you can have that in order, the higher the value you're going to get on your business if you're to sell it, or the bigger the discount you can get on the business you're going to acquire. The way we look at it, Jess, is 75% of the value of a business is in its intangible assets. 25% is in the tangible asset. And so the intangibles is all of the things I was just talking about. So if you can really get those intangibles really wired well, your acquirer is going to, you know, pay you maybe even a multiple higher for that. But if you're the chief cook, bottle washer, you know, the host, if you're everything, you're going to get discounted greatly for that, even though you've got a very profitable business. And so we teach and educate our owners that, you know, if we have 5 years to work with them on that, we can really make a difference for them on their valuation. Or we can help them target businesses that maybe are struggling in leadership, or maybe they don't have the ERP system in place that our client does have. And we can show them how they can really get some upside value by bringing the company inside.
Yeah. You know, I think about M&A, and, you know, the statistics in some of the reports are incredible. I think I remember reading a KPMG report saying that like 88% of companies that were acquired ended up being worth less than was paid for them. And you look at some of the winners, you look at the Warren Buffetts of the world who buy somebody and leave them alone. Or like, you know, when Microsoft bought LinkedIn and left them alone.
Yeah.
Right. And right. And just do incredible on it. Like, they bought a business for what they are. And I want to see if you feel different than me. I think about the CEOs who talk to me and just absolutely complain about their acquirer.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, so they bought me because they bought this business from me. And then they told me, oh yeah, you're going to make so much more money on the earnout because you're going to do this and this. And then they removed my authority to make the real decisions. And then they tried to build it. They tried to change it into a different kind of business and it didn't make any money. And I didn't have the control to make my own earnout.
Yeah. Totally agree with you. In fact, that was one of my hard lessons learned in making acquisitions, thinking I was lulled into this idea about synergy. And that word has, you know, I think that's a tough word to hang your hat on when you're as a reason to make an acquisition. And what I learned was, is not everything is synergistic by just centralizing or pulling it all together. There's a lot of reasons to decentralize, keep things decentralized. And so the art is learning what makes sense to centralize, what makes sense to decentralize. When we have three clients in the last 5 years that sold their business that each had an earnout. And as we helped them negotiate their agreements, we made sure that they had full operating authority on that earnout. And they actually, all three of them have done very, very well by doing that. And the acquirer did very well. Now, it took us some time to make sure the acquirer understood, but, you know, our point was, as we were negotiating with them as their intermediary, is why are you buying this business? You're buying the business because of the human capital. You're because of the founder here, and you believe their track record is going to continue forward for another 3 years, and the business owner who's selling it to you believes it as well, so let him do it or let her do it. And you're going to win, and they're going to win. And so that was that's the only way I'd recommend earnouts. Usually have, you know, huge negative connotations there. We don't recommend earnouts if you don't have full authority in making the decisions and holding the boundaries tight on the business model. Once the earnout was over, then some things started to change. We had to prepare. Now, the owner left, but the rest of the organization was in there and said, look, your name's going to change. It's going to be slow. You're probably going to go on to a new ERP platform. And sure enough, those things have started to happen. But the company is still performing well.
In one of the other companies I own, it's a consulting business, help with leadership and CEO coaching and executive coaching, stuff like this. And one of my longest running clients over there, started with them 9 years ago, actually. They're now, I want to say, $18 billion. And I've been through two mergers with them. Kind of doubling each time kind of thing. And the first time they were the acquirer and the second time they were the acquiree. Imagine the bureaucracy on businesses of that size, right? And it's been interesting to be like a semi-disinterested third party, but really knowing the inner workings.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, right.
And compared to like a lot of my friends who are like, you know, they sell business for a few million or something, you know, they're not the multi-billion dollar transactions, right?
Right.
And you can't believe the amount of employee angst over switching computer systems. I mean, the hundreds of hours complaining about the new computer system.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's almost insurmountable, the number, right?
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's
well, it ain't broke. It ain't broke. Why do we have to fix it, boss?
Yeah. 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 No, I agree. I'm curious to see if you agree with this, that, and I've never done anything near to the size of what you just talked about in the billions of dollars. So my transactions have been anywhere from 10 to 100 million. But I think the smaller ones, the smaller transactions require more work than the larger transactions. Would you agree with that?
So, and I should be clear, I was not involved in the transaction at all. I was just working with one regional president that's a, you know, large chunk of the business, but so I wasn't, you know, I was in a headquarters thing. You know, I'm hearing the flow through of it, right?
Okay.
But I mean, one thing that I will say about it is the smaller organizations are more family-like, are more sports team-like, are more, you know, everybody's, there's a lot of opinions and there's a lot of quite personality-based culture in my observation where, you know, when you're already a multi-billion dollar company, like there's this pervasive culture, but I mean, like in some ways you can compare more to the government than a high performance sports team.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
In certain ways, like, and so I think this kind of like, you know, my dad was a government employee and that same business, we have done a lot of work in the special operations community. And, you know, there's a lot of like resigning yourself to those idiots at headquarters. You know, like they've had years for the idiots at headquarters to make their life worse.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And so there is like, you know, that joke around the one farmer goes and talks to the old farmer, a buddy of his, and the guy's dog is on the porch just whining away. And he's like, "What's wrong with your dog?" He's like, "Oh, he's laying on a nail." "What? Why doesn't he get up?" He goes, "Oh, it doesn't hurt that bad." You know? This is like some of the more larger bureaucratic, yeah. And don't get me wrong, there's some attrition and there's some people that needed to go and some, but like some of it is like, oh, everybody's whining. Why don't they do something about it? Oh, it doesn't hurt that bad.
Yeah, right.
Where the smaller operation, when people had like a lot of control and like, you know, the culture difference of a small organization, especially getting absorbed into quite a large organization, you know, that can kind of be like oil and water a little of like, hey, we got a bunch of hardcore entrepreneurs who move fast and make decisions and, you know, there are generalists who can do this and this. And all of a sudden you're in this big organization that's got slow moving folks, but they've got all those things you used to do. Now there's six specialists who each one of those six are better than you at the six things you used to do. You know, so there's, and there's just mindsets, right?
Yeah.
Like some people are here to punch a clock and have money at their job.
Yeah.
And people in the fast growing startup, they were like on a mission. Like they were on a cause, like they need to pay the rent.
Yeah.
Like they were there to change the world. And
yeah.
Now they're part of, you know, they're part of this big bureaucracy and their coworkers, you know, are maybe a bit more a bunch of clock punchers, right?
Yeah. It's all around change management, I think. And what's interesting, your analogy, I think in the bigger corporations, because there are so many people, there's so much redundancy that they become accustomed maybe to change and it's more institutionalized and whereas when you're in a scrappy family business and you're on mission and your formula is really, really working, and then all of a sudden change occurs, like a new ERP system, well, then it's really hard to get that smaller business to transition themselves to that change. The change is inevitable. It's external to them, but how do they themselves lead themselves to that change? That's where I think it's the real effort.
Yeah, my observation too is the large organizations are much more patient about the change taking place.
Yeah,
you know, I think they started whining about the computer system change for a good 18 months before it even started.
Yes,
mm-hmm. You know what I mean. And then it was like, you know, another year or two.
Yeah.
And it was mostly over. I mean, like, it's like 3-4 years in, there's still like some legacy to the others. When like you're a small organization, you get bought by somebody big, like the you know, the axe drops and the old way is over.
And you have no additional resources really to onboard to the new system. You have to keep doing your job while learning a new system versus in the large organizations, you know, they can kind of bring it along.
You know, the cultural thing I think is really big too. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, but it's kind of like, you know, when you get married, you had all these like preconceptions about what it was like to be married because you saw your parents' marriage and the people in your neighborhood's marriage and stuff. But then your spouse grew up with a different set of parents. And like, you know, like my wife, I don't know if she's ever taken the trash out. She's like, that's a dad's job. Like she does not. Yeah. No, I'm not taking the trash out. That's a dad's job. Yeah. I was like, it wasn't in my house. She's like, well, it's going to be in ours.
Yeah. Right.
And we had these preconceptions about how things work. And, you know, especially around money. I mean, think number one cause, you know, number one most listed item in divorces is about financial stress. Right. And it's like, there's so many things that you don't even know that you're thinking differently about it because you're taking it so for granted.
Yeah.
You know, I remember in some integration sessions I was leading with you know, senior leaders saying like, if you guys don't talk about this stuff, there's going to be so much friction. Like, for instance, let's talk about one item. I know for a fact in one, you know, you guys are merging some yards, and I know for a fact in one of the companies in this room, if you get caught in a forklift without a seatbelt on, it's an on-the-spot firing. And I know at the other organization, there's an attitude of like, well, we're all adults. You can decide when you need to wear it or not. So at this new combined yard, which is it?
Yeah.
And if nobody writes it down and nobody discusses it, anybody see some opportunity for friction? Like, you fired Joe? Why did you fire? What would he be? Wait, you know, a seatbelt on. He was going 4 feet. What do you know, right?
Yeah.
Think about the...
Yeah,
the emotions and the friction and the over something like something that small. What about the big things?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, totally agree. Yeah, it's in fact we think it's the culture that's the biggest break point of any kind of integration. If you don't get the culture right, you're going to probably have the statistics like you said 88% of acquisitions or mergers are not successful. I think it's because of they can't get the culture integrated correctly. And the culture has to be part of the due diligence at the very beginning. In other words, I used to always ask our due diligence team to be thinking about where are the gaps between their culture and our culture, and can we close them or not? Because I knew down the road in trying to do the integration, if we couldn't close those gaps, if there's too many, or the gap is too wide, it was not going to work. And we would probably have to do something different.
And one thing I'll add is the ego of the acquirer, right?
Yeah. Like,
as the boss, we feel entitled to be allowed to make all the changes we want, I think. And no matter what we said about how we were going to let somebody make their own choice and stuff, we think they're making a mistake. And
yeah.
The thing is, they might be. But statistically, they've been running this for how many years at what type of profit margin? I've never run it before. Maybe I should be checking my opinions against my track record before expressing them so vehemently, or you know, saying, "Well, I'm the boss," you know. And I do think, you know, the humility of Warren Buffett to let that awesome CEO keep being an awesome CEO instead of, because he would have people. I mean, he talks about this in his shareholder letters and his speeches about. CEO's calling up saying, well, can I do this or can I do that? And he's like, you know your business way better than I do. That's why I pay you.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah.
If you're generating more profits than you can reinvest at a high rate of return, that needs to go out to the parent company because that's my skill set. I can reinvest profits, you know, at a high rate of return. So other than that, like, this is your deal, man.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know?
And it's the right philosophy, right?
And why do people love working for him?
Yeah.
Okay, I want to go for another question. When you think about how many founders or CEOs, like this is their first time at bat, you know, like they're in the major leagues, transaction in the millions and millions, but this is their first time ever doing this. Like they haven't had any practice rounds. They weren't on an M&A team, right? What's a rookie mistake? What's something they need to watch out for?
Not having a great advisory team. I think you really need to surround yourself with good advisors and a good, and I don't mean just one advisor, but I would have a team of advisors and make sure that they are aligned with what you're aligned with trying to create, whether it's an acquisition or a merger. So rookie mistake is you can do it on your own and you can just, or you can do it with your team. you've got to have an advisory team. So that would be, to me, the biggest mistake that they make. Try to do it on their own.
In addition to that, when you think of your clients who have done really well and they've been super successful, what's something you see in common with them amongst their exits?
That they've done very well in their exits?
Yeah, like a client who was super happy. They got the valuation they were looking for. The transaction went the way they looked for. You know, what are some success traits you see across those clients in addition to advisors?
By far and away, the most successful exits have been that the owner who was exiting knew what he was going to do in his next chapter of life. He had a purpose and an identity beyond his business. I've seen and witnessed instant millionaires, you know, multiple millions of dollars coming in that would make this individual and his family set for generations, generational wealth, and they are devastated because they sold their business and they didn't have an identity beyond their business. They didn't have a purpose beyond their business, and they were miserable. So I kind of look at the whole package. It's not just financial. How, you know, did you get a 17x multiple? Did you get a 30x multiple? Well, that's a lot better than a 7x multiple. No, I don't think so. I think it's, you know, are you going to be happy after you exit your business? And how do you define happiness? And how does that relate to your prosperity and your legacy? So that's my experience.
Any tips? Any tips for helping people plan that they're not going to lose their identity?
Yeah, start now. In other words, if you're a business owner today and you've got 10 years, even 15 years before you're going to exit, now's the time to start on that and start thinking about. And, you know, one of the tests that I ask my CEOs to do is go to your wife, go to your children, go to your best friend, go to your neighbor and ask them who you are to them. And I'll guarantee you, they're not going to say, oh, you're CEO of the ABC company. And you do that test, you're going to find out that you're bigger and more than what you created as a business owner. And then that will help you start to be thinking about what you're going to do in your next half of your life after you exit. That would be my tip.
Yeah, it's funny. I feel like that's a similar thing for moms when their last kid graduates high school.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's this, well, now what do I do with myself all day? And
yeah,
some of those kind of questions, right?
Yeah, it's exactly the same, I think, because a business owner has many cases that they're first generation business owners. They grew it. If they're second generation, it was their father's or mother's business that they then grew. And so they have this obligation. By the time you get to third generation, you get a little bit detached from the founding generation. And if you're successful in the third generation, you'll probably already have a better idea of what your purpose is going to be after the exit. But the first two generations have a very difficult time with that.
Yeah. My wife, you know, our youngest is out in 5 years, and she just decided to go back to school.
Yeah.
You know, and to start thinking about this ahead of time. And she wants to be a therapist and help in the prisons and you know, people who, you know, folks who could use some extra help, you know, and she's getting started now.
I think that's the largest, there's two large untapped communities out there in our society today that can contribute a lot more. And that's full-time moms that now are empty nesters and are senior citizens. Senior citizens that retire. I don't know why we all decide that, okay, once you turn 65, you just go out and go away. And I mean, there's so much that senior citizens like myself and others can offer up. And same thing with moms, with empty nesters.
Yeah,
I totally agree.
You know, my my hero in life is my mom's dad, my grandpa James, Jim Bridge. And I, like, if I ever grow up, that's who I'm hoping to be like, you know?
Yeah.
And strong family business, you know, he took over from his father-in-law who'd taken over from his father in our little farm town and stuff. So, anyways, it was sad when he sold the mercantile, you know, cause that was kind of our family thing a bit, but great for him and a big blessing for him and his family. And, but, I guess he's such a hero to me. It really makes me think, I can't stop talking about Warren Buffett this episode, but where Warren Buffett loves, really experienced managers and does not have them retire at 65 if they don't want to. And he says, it's hard to teach a new dog old tricks.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I've been lucky enough to have really great mentors who are often, you know, my dad's age or older, and was able to sometimes, not always, humble myself enough to listen to them. And I feel like I did get to skip a lot of hard things.
Yes.
Because of them. And, you know, it's actually one of my favorite things about this podcast, you know, is like, you're telling me stories from the 80s when I was a punk kid skateboarding around that humans are still humans.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? It's 30, 40 years later and things are different, but they're probably more the same than they are different as far as human nature.
Yeah.
In my observation. I agree with I don't know what you think.
On human nature. That's right. I think the thing that's different is things are happening faster, just faster than ever before. And so you have to be a lot more agile and ready to go. And I agree with you on the mentors. I had three or four very, very solid mentors that helped me. And I try to pay it forward myself and in my mentoring. And I think the best way I can mentor young leaders is by sharing the experiences I've had. And if you've been in business 40 years, you're going to have a lot more experiences than if you've been in business 15 years or 10 years. It's not that I'm smarter intellectually. I'm probably not, but I just have experienced a deal gone bad. I just experienced a $100 million customer walking away. So I know what those things are like, and I know how to be resilient and recover, and that the world isn't going to end. The sun will come up the next day when something tragic like that happens. So I agree. I think experienced mentors are terrific to have in your life, whether you're a business mentor or even maybe a life mentor.
Yeah. Well, if people want to find out more about your business or reach out to you, what are the best places?
Yeah, the best place, go to our website at ferguson-alliance.com. We got a plethora of information there, a really great resource library all around family businesses. You can also email me at rob@ferguson-alliance.com.
That's so great. Well, I appreciate you spending time here today to share your experiences.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Jess, for having me. I enjoyed the conversation.
Yeah. Well, bye everyone. And thank you for listening.